canvassing the breadth of the nation. Melisande would find no welcome on D'Angeline's soil. It was enough. It would have to be enough. In a formal ceremony of thanks, Isandre de la Courcelle restored the sovereignty of the fortress to the Duchesse de Toilemont, who had evacuated her holdings to spend the battle safe under the hospitality of Roxane de Morelliot, the Lady of Marsilicos. A considerable portion of the Scaldi ransom would go to restoring the estate and compensating the folk of Toilemont for their losses. Some would go to paying the army's retainers, and the remainder to making good against the swath of devastation the Scaldi had cut through Namar, including the restoration of Namar's temples. I was glad to hear it, having not forgotten the priestess of Namar, who had saved me in the Scaldi encampment. These things Isandre faced with a pragmatic fortitude, setting herself resolutely to dealing with them. Grapes were beginning to hang heavy on the vine when we shifted our encampment, beginning the long triumphal journey south to Terre d'Ange. Of all the journeys I have made, though this was one of the shortest, surely it was the most glorious. Encumbered by a goodly number of D'Angeline troops and the whole of the Alban army, our progress was slow, for the folk of Terre d'Ange turned out the whole length of the way, throwing blossoms in Isandre's path and cheering her as their queen. They cheered Drustan, too, who rode beside her, coming to stare at his blue features and staying to shout and throw petals. Among the Cruinia and the Dalriada, the quick dark folk of the Culloch Gorham, the fair Eidlach Orr, the brawny Tariff Crow, and the tall Falair Born, not a one had departed for Alba's shores, waiting on the promised wedding that would bond our two peoples and open the straits for good. I rode often alongside Grania's chariot on that journey, to let her know that Eamon's loss was not forgotten. Not by me, at least. I said nothing of the blood-stained sack that swung from her chariot, but Dalriada have their own superstitions. Eamon's body lay buried in the fields of Toilemont. If his sister wished to ensure that his head would watch forevermore over the seat of the Dalriada in Innisclan, it was not my place to gainsay it. Drustan knew, I think, all the Cruinia did. I never told Isandre, though. So we came at last to the city of Elawa, which had been long weeks preparing for our arrival, and rode in triumph through her streets while the whole of the city turned out to greet us. It was a strangeness to me to ride in that procession. Only once before had I witnessed a military triumph in the city of Elawa. It had been the day of Alcuin's debut, and I remembered it well. How I had watched from the terrace of Cecily Laveau-Perrin's townhouse those who had passed, so many of them dead. The Lioness of Arzal and Baudouin de Trevelyan, at whose side Melisande had ridden. Isandre, with her grandfather, Ganelon de la Courcelle, and, oh, the allies of Cumlach, with Isidore d'Eglamour at their head. It had seemed so clear and orderly, seeing it from above. Nothing is as it appears from beyond. And Anarfield de Launay had been alive that day, winning at Cotabos. And Alcuin, Alcuin who had borne the auction of his virginity with such dignity. I could not explain the tears that pricked my eyes as we rode in triumph through the city of Elawa. Most took them for tears of joy for a safe homecoming, and I let it stand, the feeling running too deep in me for words. Decimated by sickness and war, the city had room enough to hold us all. Common soldiers in the barracks, and Alban nobles housed within the palace. I had no home, but Isandre retained me in her service, giving me a suite of rooms within the palace itself, for she had need still of my skills as a linguist. Then there were joyful reunions. Chiefest among them was Cecily Laveau-Perrin, who came with Telesis de Mornay to pay a visit. I was glad enough to see the Queen's poet, but I had not reckoned on how my heart would swell to see Cecily, her beautiful face so gracefully aging, the gentle affection in her pale blue eyes. I fell on her neck and wept unabashedly. "There, there," she murmured, patting my back. "There, there." When I had regained my composure, she took my face in her hands. "Phaedra, child, few of Narmer's servants ever know truly what it is to walk in her footsteps. I have prayed every day for your safe return." Jocelyn hovered awkwardly in the background, unsure how to respond to this unexpected display of emotion on my part. But Cecily had lost none of the niceties of Sirius House, and put him at ease instantly, taking his hands and giving him the kiss of greeting. "Such a beautiful young man, Jocelyn Verai," she said lightly, turning his hands in hers and studying the Castellan vambraces he wore, coupled now with midnight blue Courcelle livery. "And a true hero as well." Cecily's eyes twinkled as she tapped his vambraces. "Never let it be said Narmer lacks a sense of humour." He blushed to the roots of his hair and bowed. "From the Queen of the Night-Blooming Flowers, I will accept such a compliment." Telesis de Mornay regarded us all fondly with her dark, glowing gaze. "Truly," she said in her musical voice, "Elowa's blessing is on this day. For all that is lost, yet so much is won." Her words struck a chord in me, granting sanction to grief and joy alike. It was true, there had been so many losses, so many that I felt their absence like a stone in my heart. And yet, indeed, we had won so much. Victory and freedom for the earth and soul of Terre d'Ange, love, liberty, and our very lives. It was fitting and meet that we should celebrate these things. So say the tenets of Blessed Elowa, who shed his blood for the land, for humanity, and smiled, through war and death and betrayal. The bee is in the lavender, the honey fills the comb. We were home. Chapter 94. In defiance of death, d'Angelines celebrate life. It was for this reason, I think, above all, that Isandra and Drustin's wedding became the grand affair that it did, and for anyone tempted to think that she kept me in her service out of kindness in those weeks of preparation, let me say, I earned my keep. Somewhere amid the chaos, I found time to tend to those promises of my own I had to fulfill. Telesis de Mornay was a great boon, setting the deeds of our quest and the great battle to verse, and translating them as well into Cruinia, for I had promised Drustin that his folk would know of their deeds. How many people she interviewed for this tale, I cannot say, but a great many of them. Though her health was never so good as it had been before the fever struck her, she spent herself tirelessly on her craft. It became in the end a mighty epic, and she worked all the days of her life on the Isandrine cycle, so named because it charted the tumultuous ascension of Isandre de la Courcelle to the throne of Terre d'Ange, though it is in truth many folk stories, mine own included. But she had been Ganelon's favourite poet for many years, and knew well enough how to turn out verse for an occasion, so we had the beginnings of it in time for the wedding. As it happened, she had begun work on it from the day four couriers styling themselves Phaedra's boys stormed into the city with a letter in hand and news of great doings. A party of riders hand-picked by Drustin set forth for Azal to meet Raus's fleet and be carried to Alba, carrying the tale locked in memory to Cruinia and Dalriada alike, bearing assurance of a victory won and an alliance made, and the return of the Cruach to come. Quintilius Raus himself guaranteed their crossing, having left Jean Marchand in command of the fleet and Marc de Trevelyan to hold the border, that he might come to the palace in person, roaring and bluff as ever, gathering me in an embrace that nearly cracked my ribs. On behalf of those couriers who had brought my plea to Telesis de Mornay and the rest of Phaedra's boys, I kept my vow made on the ancient Tiberian roads of Alba, and met with Jareth Morin, Darwain of Sirius House, first among the 13 houses of the Night Court. The token he had given me the night of Baudouin's natal festivities was long gone, seized along with all of Delaunay's holdings. But Cecily Laveau-Perrin came at my side and made a bargain with him that would have made an adept of Bryony House weep with envy. 15 tokens, one for each of Phaedra's surviving boys, to grant free passage to any of the 13 houses on the eve of Isandra's wedding. But he was no fool, Jareth Morin. My name and my tale were known, in some part, an odd scarlet thread in the tapestry of D'Angeline victory. Delaunay's Anguissette, who had survived slavery in Scaldia, who had ridden to Alba. I was born and bred to the Night Court, raised in Sirius House. The Darwain opened his doors to Phaedra's boys, and traded on my name to restore a measure of luster to the mythos of the Night Court. No matter that I'd had naught to do with him since I was 10 years old, and Delaunay came to claim me. I'd been born to it, which was true, and I kept my promise, which was what mattered to me. For the last of it, I brought the deed to Hyacinth's house and his holdings to his crew in Knight's doorstep, finding a meal, as he had bid me, and giving into his keeping the deed that Hyacinth had written on scraped parchment in the lonely tower of the Master of the Straits. Emile wept and kissed my hands, blessing me profusely, out of joy in part, and out of sorrow for Hyacinth's fate in larger part. It touched me to see how much truly they had cared for him. Prince of Travellers. I made an offering then in his mother's name at the Temple of Elowa, where we had gone together after Baudouin's death. Clutching the scarlet anemones, damp with dew, I laid them at the base of the statue, kneeling to kiss Elowa's cool marble feet. "For Anastasia, daughter of Manoj," I murmured, smelling all around me the moist soil and green things growing, the deep shade of the mighty oaks. Far above me, Elowa's vast features bent an enigmatic smile through the gloaming twilight. I knelt there a long while. This time it was Jocelyn's hands that bid me rise. But the priest of Elowa was there. The same, I swear it, though all priests and priestesses resemble each other in some way, for they are all part of an unbroken line of service. He smiled at us, barefooted in the damp mast, hands in the sleeves of his robe. "Carseal, child," he said gently, remonstrating Jocelyn, "do not rush. You have stood at the crossroads and chosen, and like Carseal, you will ever stand at the crossroads and choose. Choose again and again the path of the companion. The choice lies ever within you, the crossroads and the way, and Elowa's commandment to point you on it." Jocelyn gave him a startled look, but the priest was already reaching out one hand, laying it upon my cheek. "Kushiel's dart and Nama's servant," he smiled, leaf-shadowed in the twilight, a smile of blessing, of remembrance, I thought. Who could say? I believed him the same priest. "Love as thou wilt, and Elowa will ever guide your steps." He left us to linger there. When he had gone, I laughed. "It seems my turn for dire prophecy has passed." "You can have mine," Jocelyn said wryly. "It seems I'm doomed to make the same choice 1,000 times over."
"Are you sorry?" I searched his face in the faint light.
"No." Jocelyn shook his head. "No," he whispered, and took my face in his hands, lowering his head to kiss me, unbound hair the colour of summer wheat falling forward to curtain us. It was sweet, very sweet, and I felt the rightness of it in our shared breath, the steady beat of his heart matching time with my own. When he lifted his head, the shadow of a smile curved his lips. "But there will likely be times when I am." "Likely there will," I murmured, "as long as it's not now." No, he said, and smiled in full. Not now. Above our heads, Elawa's marble hands remained spread in blessing. Thus did I keep the promises I had made on that long and terrible journey. And afterward, you may be sure, Isandre de la Courcelle had me dancing attendance upon her to make up for time lost on my own business. While she bid fair to make a wise and compassionate ruler, she was also a d'Angeline noblewoman approaching her wedding day, and indulged her foibles accordingly. Never in her life had she been allowed the luxury of being girlish. If she seized it now, I, who had been raised to fripperies, could not blame her. One such, which demanded my attention, was the bedecking of Alban royalty in d'Angeline finery, to wit, the splendid gown Isandre commissioned for Grognier. The Queen of Terre d'Ange was more than a little fascinated with the warrior queen of the Dalriada. There must have been 80 women fighting among the Albans, but Grognier was the only one whose status was, in its own way, comparable to Isandre's. Aemon's death had not diminished her. If her bright spirit was banked with sorrow, it was deepened as well. She stood patiently beneath the royal tailor's prodding as he fitted her, showing a glimmer of her old amusement as she caught my eye. The gown, a glory of scarlet silk and gold brocade, was too narrow through the waist, though she had been measured no more than a week prior. I listened to the tailor's muttering and laughed. "How long?" I asked Grognier in Erin. 3 months. She laid her hand on the faint swell of her belly and smiled complacently. "If it is a boy, I will name him Aemon." "Is it Rouse's?" She smiled again. "It may be so." Isandre raised impatient brows. She spoke some bit of Cruinia, but the Erin dialect took time to master, or great necessity. I'd had the advantage of both. I explained to her what Grognier had said. "She fought," Isandre said in astonishment, "with child?" "It was too soon to be sure, then," I said diplomatically. "There is a dreadful Erin tale about an ancient queen running a foot race great with child. I spared her that, and was glad I'd not told her about Aemon's head, preserved in quicklime." "Will Quintilius Rouse wed her?" Isandre inquired. I translated for Grognier, who laughed. "I do not think it matters to her, my lady," I replied. "That's fine," Isandre said to the royal tailor, waving one hand dismissively. "Make the adjustments." She looked consideringly at me. "What of you, near cousin? Will you wed your Carceline?" One does not refuse to answer a direct question from one's sovereign, but glancing at her face, I saw that she was genuinely interested. "No, my lady," I said simply. "Anathema or no, Carceline vows bind for a lifetime. Jocelyn betrays them every day he is with me, and that is his choice. To wed would be a mockery, and that he cannot do, nor I ask." Isandre, I think, understood. Her ever-present Carceline guard stared straight ahead, and what they thought I cannot guess, nor did I care. "Will you return to Narmar's service?" she asked then. "I don't know." I busied myself with assisting Grognier as she divested herself and dressed in her own garb, handing her kirtle over the tailor's folding modesty screen. It was one of those questions that lay between Jocelyn and I, and one we had avoided. I faced it now, in part, meeting Isandre's gaze. "You have been kind, Your Majesty, and I have assurances of hospitality from good friends." It was true. Gaspard Trevelyan had promised I should never want for aught, and Cecily and Telesis as well. But if I am rich in friends, I am penniless in pocket. This too was true, and a considerable fortune awaited me as a servant of Narmar. There were other reasons too, but those were harder to voice. Poverty, everyone understood. "Oh, that!" Isandre laughed, beckoning to a page. "Summon the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Tell him it's regarding Lord de Launay's estate."
He came with alacrity, a lean and grizzled man, clutching sheaves of paper. Ysandra had dismissed the royal tailor by then and given Grainne leave to go, which she took, bending one last look of quiet amusement my way. "Go on," Ysandra bid the Chancellor, reclining on a couch and sipping at a glass of wine. I sat in a chair and gazed with perplexity as he cleared his throat and shuffled through his papers.
"Yes, Your Majesty. Regarding Arnulfiel de Launay's estate, the townhouse in the city, and all its holdings, it seems these were purchased from the judiciary by one," he peered at a parchment, "Lord Sandriel Vulcan, who deeded it to..." "Well, it doesn't matter. We can begin proceedings for its reclamation at your insistence, my Lady Fedra, or the Exchequer will recompense you the full amount of the sale."
"Why?" I interrupted, out of pure bewilderment. The Chancellor of the Exchequer looked at me over his papers, startled.
"Oh, you didn't, Your Majesty. Well, of course, my lady. His Lordship, Arnulfiel de Launay, filed the papers some time ago, naming you his heir. You and one," he consulted a sheet, "Alcuin no de Launay, deceased. By Her Majesty's proclamation of your innocence, our seizure is now unlawful, and we must by rights recompense you."
I opened my mouth and closed it, in my shock picturing the house as I'd last seen it, a dreadful abattoir, de Launay dead and Alcuin dying.
"I don't want it," I said, shuddering. "Not the house. Let Lord Sandriel or whomever keep it. If I am owed..."
It was hard to credit.
"If I am owed, well then, fine." "Yes, of course, quite," the Chancellor said absently, shuffling through his papers. "Recompense in full." Ysandra sipped her wine and smiled. "And then there is Montrev, of course," he added.
"Montrev?" I echoed the word like a simpleton.
"Montrev in Siobhal, yes."
His gaze came into focus as he found the document for which he was searching, tapping it smartly. "With his disinheritance, upon his father's death, it passed to his mother, and thence to Lord de Launay's cousin, Rufail, who is, sadly, listed among the dead of Toilemont." The Chancellor cleared his throat again.
"A codicil in the will of the Comtesse de Montrev specifies that if he should die without issue, the estate would revert to her son, Arnulfiel de Launay, or his heirs." "And that, it seems, is the case, my lady."
Although his words clearly formed sentences, I could make no sense of them. He might as well have been speaking Arcadian, for all I understood.
"What he is saying, Fedra," Ysandra said succinctly, "is that you have inherited the title and estate of Comtesse de Montrev."
I stared blankly at her.
"My lady will have her jest."
"Her Majesty does not jest," the Chancellor of the Exchequer said reproachfully to me, and rattled his sheaf of papers. "It's all very clear, and documented in the archives of the Royal Treasury."
"Thank you, my Lord Brenois," Ysandra said graciously to the Chancellor. "Will you draw up the papers of investiture?"
"Your Majesty."
He bowed deeply, hugging his sheaves to him, and hurried out of the royal presence.
"You knew," I said to Ysandra, my voice sounding strange to my ears.
She took a sip of wine and shook her head.
"Not about Montrev, no.
That only came to light after the lists were published, and Lord Brenois determined that Rufail de Montrev had designated no heir. You may refuse, of course, but it was de Launay's mother's wish that the estate return to her son, or his line, and he chose you, you and the boy Alcuin."
"De Launay," I whispered.
He had never told me. I wondered if Alcuin had known.
"No, I accept."
"Good," Ysandra said simply. Afterward, the matter was concluded in her mind,
and Isandra consulted with me on some small choices of jewelry and hairstyle for her wedding day. What I said, I have no idea. My mind was reeling, dumbstruck. She was queen of Terre d'Ange. Montrevel was naught to her. A tiny mountainous Siovalese holding, with nothing to offer but a score of men-at-arms and a decent library. It was interesting only in that it had begotten Anarfield de Launay, whom her father had loved. So it was to her. To me, named by the ancient Darwain of Sirius House for what I was, a whore's unwanted get, it was somewhat else indeed. When she was done with me, I went in search of Jocelyn. "What's wrong?" he asked in alarm, looking at my flushed face, my eyes bright as with fever. "Are you all right?" "No," I swallowed. "I'm a peer of the realm."
Chapter 95. Thus did it come to pass that I attended the wedding of Isandre de la Courcelle and Justin Mab Nechtner, Queen of Terre d'Ange and Cruach of Alba, as the Comtesse Phèdre Nodelaunay de Montrevel. I kept Delaunay's name out of pride. What I had, he had given me. Much of what I was, he had made me, under the name he had chosen, and not that to which he was born. I never forgot, never, that it had been he who with two words turned my deadliest flaw to a treasure beyond price. Isandra rescinded her grandfather's old edict against Delaunay's poetry, and after 20-odd years his verses were once again spoken openly, charged with all the passion and brilliance of his youth. At the wedding feast, Telesis de Mornay would debut her epic verses, in praise of bride and groom alike. But at the ceremony itself, she recited one of Delaunay's poems. I dare say the whole world knows it now. It was a rage of fashion for months afterward in the city, for lovers to quote the verse of Anarfiel de Launay to one another. Then no one had heard it, and I wept at the final words. "I and thou our hands meet, and a world engendered." It was fitting for the two of them, truly rulers of two worlds, conjoined into one. The ceremony was held in the palace gardens, with gay pavilions erected on the lawn, and a fragrant bower under which they stood. Elowa's temple is everywhere in Terre d'Ange, where earth meets sky. It was an old priestess who performed the ritual, silver-haired, her face lined and lovely with age. Isandra looked as beautiful as a summer's day, in a gown of periwinkle silk, her pale hair done up in a crown, laced with gold filigree, in which blue forget-me-nots were twined. I had counselled her well, if I had so advised her. As for Drustin, he was truly a vision to d'Angeline eyes, all his Pictish barbarism recreated in our luxuriant textiles, the red cloak of the Cruach hanging in velvet folds from his blue-whirled shoulders, gold talk against his bare brown throat. This, too, set quite a fashion. As king and queen they greeted each other, but when the words were spoken and they shared a kiss to seal it, it was as man and woman, husband and wife. I saw Isandra's eyes sparkle as they parted, and Drustin's white smile, and I cheered them with the whole heart. I knew better than anyone at what cost this union came. We dined then on the greensward, and there were many tables laid, shining with white linen and settings of silver and gold. And I was seated with Jocelyn at their own table, albeit far from the centre where they reigned. For each of us, a nuptial goblet, silver chased in gold, depicting the siege of Toilemont and the victorious alliance that followed. I have mine still, and it is among the chiefest of my treasures. Suckling pigs were roasted whole, and pheasants, and oysters rushed packed in ice from the Icelandine coast, mutton and venison and tender rabbit, cheeses and apples soaked in brandy, pears and a spicy currant sauce. There were crisp green salads with shredded violet petals and comfits and glacés.
and through it all washed a river of wine, soft oaken whites, crisp rosé, and hearty red, while musicians strolled and servants bustled. When the sun sank low, the torches were kindled, 1,000 candles set in glass globes about the garden, a beacon summoning to moths. Then did Telesis de Mornay recite her fledgling verse that would grow one day into the Isandrine cycle. Strange to hear one's name spoken in passing poem, although the focus of these verses was Isandra and Drustan, my tale was woven in it. Not a little drunk, I leaned my head in my hand and listened. After that came the toasts, which I will not recount. I had to rise when Grania, resplendent in the crimson and gold gown of Isandra's choosing, gave hers in a thick Aran accent. It was something to do with the Falair born and the honour of the Dalriada, and a wish for fruitful joy. I cannot remember now. I must have rendered it well enough, for everyone cheered. When I had done, Grania gave me thanks and named me her sister, with an embrace and a deep glimmer of amusement that was not entirely sisterly. I'd not told Isandra that, either, only that the lords of the Dalriada had been persuaded. Later I learned that Quintilius Rouse had related the tale of how I had brought the twins into accord, and Isandra laughed until she wept. It was her fault for making me her ambassador. Still, I grieved that never again would Aemon balance his sister. Drustan made a toast then, and to my great pride he gave it first in Cruinia, then in near flawless Dangeline. His dark eyes shone with wine, and the flickering light of 1,000 candles turned the intricate blue whorls of woad into a subtle shifting pattern on his skin.
"We have won this day's joy at great price," he said solemnly. "Let us treasure it all the more, and pledge together that as Isandra and I have joined our lives, so will our nations be joined in strength and harmony, that we may never be any less than what we are today."
It was well said, and they cheered him wildly. He gave a courteous bow and sat down. Then Isandra stood, so young to have borne what she had, but there was steel in Isandra de la Courcelle, forged between the bitter triangle of Roland, Isabel, and Delaunay, hammered on the anvil of her grandfather's rule, metal-tested in the dreadful siege of Toilemont. Tempered by love. "Dangeline and Alban alike," she said, "we give praise this day to blessed Eloa, and celebrate his words. Why are we here, if not for that nation, home and hearth, land, sea and sky, kith and kin, friend and lover, mistress and consort?" A rippling laugh answered, and she smiled. "And husband and wife, we honour Eloa's sacred precept. Join me, then, on this day and ever after, and love as thou wilt." No other sovereign would have given such a toast, I think, but this was Terre d'Ange, and Isandra was our queen. We drank and drank deep, servants filling our nuptial goblets with joie, that clear, bright cordial that made the torches burn brighter. Afterward, the musicians struck up in earnest, and we danced on the green lawn, while the soft candlelit twilight faded unnoticed, and the stars kindled in the black sky, a scent of flowers heady in the summer night. I danced first with Jocelyn, and then Gaspard Trevelyan bowed and extended his hand, and after that I lost count, until Drustan Mab Nechtner claimed a dance. There were whispers at that. Some of the nobles knew who I was, and some did not, but now my name was known, and Cushiel's dart gave me away. Always at court there runs the murmuring river of politics beneath the surface of any occasion. Drustan ignored it, and so did I. He danced well for an Alban, despite his lameness. I remembered the first time I'd heard his name. Isandra de la Courcelle shall teach a club-foot barbarian prince to dance the gavotte. So she had, and I danced with him now, while we smiled at one another. Kullak Gorum, Earth's eldest children. It meant nothing to the Dangelines, but they had not been there when the black boar burst from its copse outside Bryn Gorridum. I had. We always did understand one another, Drustin and I. I had patrons there, too. I'd chosen my assignations from among the highest ranked in the realm that last year or so. I gave none of them away. It was not the place to acknowledge such things. Some, like Quinsel de Morban, would not have cared. Others depended on the discretion of Narmar's servants. It did not matter. I knew and they knew, whose patron gifts were etched indelibly onto my skin, link by link, forming the chain of my mark that rendered me free. In the small hours of the morning, Isandre and Drustin took their leave, and we followed them as far as the bedchamber, a great crowd of mixed folk shouting out good wishes, and some bawdy ones, and pelting them with a hailstorm of petals, until they, laughing, closed the bedchamber door and barred it, petals clinging to their hair, and Isandre's grim castellans turned us away with an especially dour look for Jocelyn. No end to the revelry, though. The queen had bid it carry on until dawn, and I saw it through to the end, having a deep need in my soul for a joyous daybreak to cleanse away the memories of too many others. Jocelyn, too, he understood. We had had the first dance together, and we had the last. Later I would laugh to hear the forays he had endured in between, staged by Dangeline lords and ladies curious to test the virtue of a Castelline apostate. Then I merely rested safe in the circle of his arms, glad to be there, where neither of us ever thought to find ourselves. And we watched the sunrise over Terre d'Ange. The days that followed were full of activity, for there remained a great deal to be done, but my role in it, for the most part, had come to an end. When the Chancellor of the Exchequer bestowed upon me the balance of the proceeds from the sale of Delaunay's estate, I begged of him the name of a reliable agent, and made arrangements for the care and investment of my unexpected wealth. With some portion of these funds, Jocelyn spent his days making preparations for our journey to Montrevre. He would not ride alone, it seemed, for three of Fedra's boys, among those survivors of the wounded at Toilemont, begged leave to be dismissed from Rouse's service and enter mine. Quintilius Rouse acceded, and Isandre agreed to the increase in Montrevre's allotment of men-at-arms. And that is how I came to acquire three chevaliers, Remy, T. Philippe, and Fortune. Why they persisted in their extravagant loyalty, I never understood, although Jocelyn laughed and said he did. But I was glad of their presence, for I had no few trepidations regarding the welcome I would find in Montrevre. The folk there had been loyal to Delaunay's father, the old Comte de Montrevre, and, so far as I knew, to his cousin as well. Delaunay they'd not known since his youth, and me they knew not at all. Born and bred to the Night Court, I was no bloodkin of theirs. I was not even Siovalese. On the day before our departure, I received one last surprise. A royal page came to fetch me, claiming strangers at the palace gates were asking for me. Jocelyn came with me as I hurried through the palace, fearful of who awaited. His face was set and grim, hands hovering over his dagger hilts. He had leave to wear his castelline arms even in the presence of the queen. It was a kindness of Isandre's, who had seen how he felt stripped without them, and a cleverness too, for he would ever have guarded her life as his own or mine. What I expected I could not say, but we found awaiting us a young couple in simple, well-made country attire. "My Lady de Montrevre," the young man said and bowed. His wife curtsied. His face, as he straightened, was familiar, but I was too disconcerted by the greeting to place it. "I am Pernell Friot of Perrenwald. This is my wife, Richeline." She bobbed another curtsy. He gave me an open grin, eyes friendly beneath a shock of brown hair. "My nephew taught you to ride a horse, do you remember? The Lady Cecily said you might have need of a seneschal.
I did remember, with such delight that I kissed them both, to their blushing surprise. It was only then that Cecily showed herself, smiling at the success of her venture.
"Gavin swears Purnell can do aught that he can, and twice as swiftly," she said as I took her hands in gratitude. "My Perrinwold's grown too small to hold the expansion of the Freeoat clan, and you'll have need of your own folk about you. Let them work with Montrev's folk, and it will ease your way, for you'll find no kinder hearts in Terre d'Ange." Better advice I never had, and if Montrev made me welcome, it was due in no small part to the efforts of Purnell and Richeline Freeoat, who came willing to learn the ways of the estate, and in such an open and friendly manner that it won the hearts of the Siovalis as easily as Perrinwald had won mine. So it was that we were a party of seven when we departed, amid too many farewells to count, striking out once more on the open road and bound for Montrev. "When we are settled," I said to Jocelyn, as the city of Elawa dwindled behind us, "there is somewhat that I want to do." He looked inquiringly at me. "I want to visit La Reine, to find Tarvi and Darnell." Jocelyn smiled, remembering.
"I'd like that, actually. You think mayhap they might accept a gift of thanks, now that you're a peer of the realm?" he added, amused.
"They might," I said, "and they might know someone willing to tutor me in Yeshuite." I glanced over to see his fair brows rise. "If De Launay knew it, he never taught me, and the Master of the Straits was fathered and cursed by Rahab, who serves the one god of the Yeshuites. If there's aught to be found that might break his binding, it's in Yeshuite lore."
"Hyacinth," Jocelyn said softly.
I nodded.
"Well, then we'll go to La Reine," he laughed. "And, Elawa help us, you can pit yourself against the gods."
I loved him for that. Onward we rode to Montrev.
Chapter 96. It is one thing to visit a country estate, it is another to inherit one. Even with the very capable aid Cecily had bequeathed me, it took the better part of a year to settle into the rhythms of Montrev, to gain the trust and goodwill of its folk, who were understandably perplexed at how a Siovalese holding had passed into the possession of a city-bred servant of Namar. Montrev itself was beautiful, a green jewel set in the low mountains. To Jocelyn, born in Siovale, it was nearly a homecoming. We rode the length and breadth of it together, and fell in love with its simple charm, its rugged hills and green valleys, the unexpected pleasure of a meadow. It is sheep country there, and it transpired that I was rich in flocks. The manor house itself was all quaint elegance, with touches of Isandine luxury. Delaunay's mother, I guessed. It had small, brilliant gardens, rambling with colourful flowers for three quarters of the year, grown wild for lack of tending. Richeline Freeoat made these her especial care. And there was a library, where Anafio de Launay had spent his boyhood study, immersed in the Siovale's love of learning. I found his name one day, scratched with a knife point into the wooden surface of a reading table, and had to fight back tears. Jocelyn's love of the land, my love for de Launay. These things, I think, along with the good nature of the Freeoats and the bold, cheerful manner of my three chevaliers, won over the folk of Montrev. Once we were at last ensconced, I began to write letters, and Fedra's boys leapt at the chance to play courier, crossing the realm with correspondence. I wrote to Isandra, with gratitude, to Cecily Laveau-Perrin and Telesis de Mornay, with small tales of our doings, to Quintilius Rouse and Gaspard Trevelyan, with greetings, and always with a plea for news. I wrote even to Maestro Gonzago de Escabares, in care of the University of Tiberium, and Remy was gone months on that adventure. And I bought books, and in La Reine
T. Philippe found Tarvi and Darnell, owners of a prosperous tailor's shop in the Yeshuite Quarter. That spring, Jocelyn and I rode to visit them and held a happy reunion. Impossible to believe that scarcely a year ago we had met on the road, where they had saved our lives. The girls had grown taller, and our scaldy pony, still with them, had grown fatter. If they would still accept no reward, I repaid them as best I was able, with a sizable commission for livery. The insignia of Montreb was a four-quartered shield, with a crescent moon upper right and a mountain crag lower left. That was ever the standard we flew at the manor, but for Fedra's boys I added my own devices. Delaunay's sheaf of grain, and the sign of Cushiel's dart. We returned from La Reine, the richer in renewed friendships, and with one addition. Seth Benyavin, a young Yeshuite scholar, who stammered and turned red in my presence, but was nonetheless doggedly persistent in his teaching. All that spring and well into summer I studied with him, and the days slid by like water. Sometimes Jocelyn joined us, but not always. The lure of the mountains was stronger, and he would rather, he declared, learn it from me. As I gained some small proficiency, Seth began to forget I was an Anguisset, and sometimes servant of Nama, and grew more at ease in my company, arguing and debating happily. It was good to have my mind challenged and occupied, for it kept me from restlessness. We had not spoken of that, of what would happen when Cushiel's dart began to prick. I was an Anguisset. It would. But for now even I had had a sufficiency of pain. When deep summer began to give way to early fall, Seth begged leave to depart, having family duties to resume. He left with Fortune to accompany him, a generous purse of his own, and another to accompany a list of books and codices he felt I might need, and for which he promised to search. I had a long way to go in my studies, but I knew enough to begin my quest. The leaves were beginning to turn gold when Gonzago de Escabares arrived. He came unannounced, with a lone apprentice tending him, two horses and a well-laden mule between them. A little greyer and stouter, but otherwise unchanged. I threw myself on him with a cry of joy, and he laughed.
"Ah, little one, you'll give an old man the feats. Come, I'm near starved to the bone. Didn't my Antinous teach you aught about hospitality?"
I let him into the manor, talking all the while, I am sure, while Jocelyn looked on with polite bewilderment and ordered their horses stabled and the mule unpacked. Seth Benyavin had been a paid tutor. Maestro Gonzago de Escabares was my first genuine guest. In an unexpected state of nervousness, I nearly drove the household staff mad with half-brained requests, until Richeline calmly and firmly ordered me to attend to my guest and leave the arrangements to her. Over wine, which the maestro quaffed heartily, and an array of cheeses and sweetmeats, which also met a quick end, I learned that he had been travelling in the northern city-states of Caerdica Unitas, learning of the upheaval along the Scaldic border. An old colleague of his in Tiberium had received my letter, and he decided to pay a visit, bringing an apprentice who wished to learn of De Escabares's method of studying the world. It had been his plan to return home to Aragonia and begin drafting his memoirs, but upon receiving my letter he had determined to come first to Montreb, which lay nearly on his way.
"I would have sent word, my dear, but I would have outpaced it," he said, eyes twinkling. "We travelled like the wind, did we not, Camillo?"
His apprentice coughed and hid a smile, murmuring something about a rather slow breeze. I laughed and patted Gonzago's hand. "I'm just glad you're here, maestro." After they had retired and rested for a time, we dined, a meal of sufficient rustic splendour, but even the maestro was content. For my part, I ate little, overwhelmed with grateful pride that such hospitality was mine to offer. I knew full well all credit was due to the household of Montrevel and not me, but they had done it on my behalf, investing their pride in mine, and I was grateful. While we dined, I spun the long story of our journeys, beginning with the death of Alcuin and de Launay. Much of it Gonzago knew, but he wanted to hear it firsthand. Tears filled his eyes at the start. He had, in deep truth, been very fond of de Launay. To the rest of it, told in turns by Jocelyn and me, he listened with the historian's tireless fascination. Afterward he told us of his travels and the knowledge he had gleaned. The Caerdicus city-states were falling over themselves to establish trade with the no longer isolated nation of Alba, jealous of the status enjoyed by Terdange and her ally Aragonia. By the time our meal was cleared and we were lingering over brandy, the apprentice Camillo's head was nodding, and Gonzago sent him to bed.
"A good lad," he said absently. "He'll make a fine scholar some day, if he can stay awake long enough."
He rose ponderously.
"I've some gifts here for you, if he's not misplaced them," he added. "I brought a beautiful Caerdicky translation of de Launay's verse. Pity I'd have looked up some Yeshuite texts for you if I'd known, and somewhat odd beside." "I'll fetch your bags for you, maestro," Jocelyn offered, heading for his guest room.
Gonzago sank back down with a grateful sigh.
"A long trip on horseback for an old man," he remarked.
"And I thank you for making it," I smiled at him. "What do you mean, somewhat odd?"
"Well,"
he picked up his empty goblet and peered at it. I refilled it with alacrity.
"As you know, I was in La Serenissima for some time, which is where my friend Lucretius sought me. I have an acquaintance there who charts the stars for the family of the Doge. Lucretius inquired for him there, explaining his business. He even had to show the letter with your seal. They're all suspicious in La Serenissima."
He swirled the brandy in his goblet and drank.
"At any rate, my stargazing acquaintance eventually told him that I had gone on to Varro, and gave him the name of a reputable inn." "Ah, there you are."
He seized upon the pack that Jocelyn brought.
"Here,"
he said reverently, passing me a twine-bound package. I opened it with care, and found it to be the Caerdicky translation. It was beautiful indeed, bearing a tooled leather cover, with a copy of the head of Antinous, lover of the Tiberian Imperator Hadrian, worked upon it.
Jocelyn laughed. "A mendicant's trick, if ever there was one."
"Truly, maestro, it's lovely, and I thank you," I said, leaning to kiss his cheek. "Now will you keep me in suspense all night?" Gonzago de Escabares gave a rueful smile.
"You may wish I had, child. Having heard your tale, I have my guess. Hear mine, and make your own. Lucretius and his apprentice bedded down at the inn, and in the morning he found he had a guest. Now he is an eloquent man, my friend Lucretius. He is an orator after the old style, and I have never known him to be caught short of words. But when I asked him to describe his guest, he fell silent, and at last said only that she was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen."
The nights were still warm, but I felt a chill all the length of my spine. "Melisande," I whispered.
"Ask Camillo," Gonzago said bluntly. "I did, and he said that she had hair the color of night and eyes the color of larkspur, and her voice made his knees go weak, and that lad doesn't have a poetic bone in his body."
Reaching into his pack, he drew out a large bundle in a silk drawstring bag.
"She said since he was carrying a letter from the Comtesse de Montrevel to me, would he carry this to me,
for the Comtesse de Montrèves.
He handed me the bundle and I took it with trembling hands, feeling it at once soft and heavy.
"Don't open it!" White lines of fury were etched on Jocelyn's face. "Fedra, listen to me. She has no hold on you, and you owe her nothing. You don't need to know. Throw it away unopened."
"I can't," I said helplessly.
I wasn't lying either. I couldn't, nor could I open it.
With a sharp sound, Jocelyn tore the parcel from my hands and wrenched open the silken drawstring cords, reaching inside to yank out its contents. My sanglier cloak unfolded in a slither of velvet drapery to hang from his grip, rich and luxuriant, a red so deep it was almost black. We all stared at it, saying nothing. Gonzago de Escabares's eyes were round with perplexity. I don't think he knew what it was. I did. Jocelyn did. I had been wearing it that last day, the day Delaunay was killed, the day Melisande had betrayed us.
"What in the seventh hell is this supposed to mean?" Jocelyn demanded, throwing it down on the couch beside me. He gave a bewildered laugh, running his hands through his hair. "Your cloak? Do you have the faintest idea?"
He looked at me, then looked again.
"Fedra?"
I did know. Someone had aided Melisande, had helped her escape from Trois-le-Mont. Whoever it was, they had never been found. Isandra's suspicion in the end had fallen most heavily on Quinsel de Morban and Batu-Shara's kin, Marmion and Persia. If they were exonerated, it was only because there was no proof, and it was too ludicrously obvious, all of them too canny to stage such a blatant ploy. But there was another reason, I knew. I spent that night atop the battlements, and never heard a sound. The guard at the postern gate was killed by a knife to the heart. He'd seen his killer. It was someone he trusted, face to face. And the guardsmen of Trois-le-Mont didn't trust anyone who hadn't fought at their side. Certainly he would have challenged any one of the Coucheline nobles approaching him in the dark of night. Someone he trusted. Someone we all trusted. And now Melisande was in La Serenissima, close enough to the family of the Doge to learn in a day that their soothsayer had received a visitor. Prince Benedict's eldest daughter, Marie-Celeste, was wed to the Doge's son, a near-incestuous knot of the deadly Stregazza, who had poisoned Isabelle Lanvert de la Courcelle. Isandra's nearest kin, who were of the blood. Oh, I knew. My hands closed on a fold of the sanglier cloak, feeling the rich velvet beneath my fingertips. I could smell, faintly, Melisande's scent. Why had she kept it? I couldn't answer it, my mind shying away from the question. But what she meant it for now, I knew well enough. A challenge. An opening gambit. I touched my throat, bare of her diamond. Somewhere in that deadly coil of La Serenissima, a plot was hatching. It was a long way, a very long way, from Isandra's throne in the city of Elowa. But intrigue has a long reach when thrones are at stake. Someone at Isandra's right hand concealed poison at their heart. And I could find them out. That was what the cloak meant, of course. Melisande knew full well how I had served Delaunay, Alcuin and I. He'd let her know as much. Like her, he was a master, and could not bear to be entirely without an audience. One solitary witness who could appreciate his artistry, the tremendous scope and complexity of his undertaking. Whoremaster of spies, his detractors called him, when the halcyon days of Isandra's wedding and d'Angeline victory had passed. Witness and opponent, Melisande had chosen me as her equal. I was an Anguissette, and a sometime servant of Narma, that much the world knew, trained to observe, to remember, to analyze. Not many knew that. Even those who did put little stock in it. I had been at the wrong place at the right time, nothing more. I nearly believed it myself, and sometimes I think it was true. Others would find it easy to believe. Who would the gatekeeper have trusted? I could count them on my fingers. Gaspard Trevelyan, Percy de Somerville, Barquier Lambert, a half a dozen others, no more. I could find out, as I had found out that Childeric de Somme served Lambert, as I had found out that Solène Belfort was Lionette de Trevelyan's puppet. People will speak before an anguissette, careless as with no other, not even the pillow talk of the night court. I stroked the velvet pile of the sangoir cloak. Delaunay had sent all the way to Firenze to find dye-makers who could recreate it. We'd lost the art in Terre d'Ange. That didn't happen often. "Such a beautiful colour," Melisande had said once. "It suits you." It would be easy, so easy to begin again. I was born to it, I thought, blinking away the red wash that hazed my vision. Jocelyn began every morning with the smooth execution of the castline forms drilled into him since he was 10, that deadly private dance he now performed in the gardens of Montreb, while members of the household watched with covert admiration. And I channeled my gifts and their awful yearnings into my studies, which I was loath to abandon. No reason to do so, truly. What texts I had I could easily forward to the city, aught else I carried in my own skull. And there were Yeshuites aplenty in the city to carry on Seth Ben-Yavin's teaching, and the Royal Library, and booksellers too, and the bequest of Delaunay's house, largely unspent, enough to buy a home in the city, a modest home. Montreb. There was Montreb, but it would continue. I was fooling myself if I thought it needed my hand. It had its own staff and holdings, and I need never doubt the loyalty of Pernell and Richeline, happily installed, making of it a home such as his parents had at Perrenwald, in the absence of the Chevalier and his lady, Cecily. I could always come back. I would, too. I loved it here. Almost as much as I had loved being Delaunay's anguissette, bright star in Narmer's crown. Jocelyn. Ah, Jocelyn, I thought, and could have wept. My beautiful boy, if not so chaste. Truly I had an ill-luck name. How many times had I proved a trial nigh beyond bearing? How many times had I promised, this is the last? The old priest, he was the same, I was sure of it, had said it. You have stood at the crossroads and chosen, and like Carsiel, you will ever stand at the crossroads and choose. Choose again and again the path of the companion. My fault, my doing. I sank my hands into the deep, heavy fabric of my sangoir cloak. So many times I had worn it, so many assignations, always blind to Delaunay's purpose, obedient nonetheless. It would be different to do it knowing. It would be different carrying the secret of my own purpose locked within the vault of my heart, playing counter to Melisande's deadly game. It would be harder. My heart beat faster at the prospect, and the tide of desire surged within my blood, relentless and unending. How close need I get before someone's careless lips spilled the secret, revealing their lord or lady to be the traitor of Trois-le-Mont? For there were Isandra's ladies in waiting, too, those three who had dared to follow her into the teeth of war. I knew their names and faces, locked in memory. Who knew but that one of them was Melisande's last line of defence? She always rewarded generously those who had served her. I touched my throat, still bare. No matter. Her generosity, too, was emblazoned on my skin, the finial at the nape of my neck that completed my mark, forever etched by Master Tialar's exquisitely painful tapper. Hers, her doing. a gown of sheerest gauze, studded with diamonds. They had bitten deep into my flesh when I knelt for her. They had bought me my freedom. Melisande, they might cost her freedom yet. If I had lost my mentor, still I was not without resources. I had the friendship of the sovereigns of two nations, the Lady of the Dalriada, the Royal Admiral. I had the kindness of a revered scholar of the University of Tiberium to aid me, the goodwill of the Yeshuite community, and a standing claim with one of the Companias of the Tsingani. I had friends high and low, and the enduring love of the successor to the Master of the Straits, my dearest friend. And I had the perfect companion.
Fedra?
Jocelyn repeated my name, the question still in his voice, echoed in Gonzago de Escobares's perplexed gaze. So much thought to have passed in the blink of an eye. I drew a deep breath and looked at Jocelyn's face, familiar and concerned, against all odds, beloved. No more dire prophecies, I had laughed, not reckoning with what I was, with what the priest had named me, sure and true. Kushiel's dart and Namar's servant. Love as thou wilt, and Eloa will ever guide your steps. I'll tell you, I said, tomorrow. This concludes Kushiel's dart.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.